10:13. Let's get started. Welcome to our August meeting, everybody, in a new venue. So the opening item is to call it to order. And item number two is election of commission president and vice president.
I move to elect Jessica Levinson to another term as president.
Second.
Thank you. All right. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Great. Thank you. Thank you for your trust as we move forward. And I will nominate Serena Oberstein to continue as vice president.
I'll second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
This was a approved. This was a smooth non-transition of power. Thank you, everybody. I would like the presidential candidates to observe how easily this can go.
Ms. President, it would be appropriate to make clear for the listening public to state on the record that we have four commissioners present, and including Commissioner Murray, Oberstein, Levinson, and DeHaan, and it was a unanimous vote.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And as always, I am only as good as those who help me. And we also have a new almost commissioner, I understand, Andrea Odin, who is being hopefully confirmed right now, and we're very much looking forward to her joining us. And she has essentially served on 18 commissions here at the City of Los Angeles, and I think she'll be a wonderful addition. So, draft minutes. I would move to approve the draft minutes of our June 21st summer solstice meeting. Are there any questions on the draft minutes? Is there a second?
I'll second.
Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
Okay, the draft minutes are approved. Item number four, possible neighborhood council discussion.
We have not been presented with any resolution or community impact statement.
So. Okay. Then it is good we phrase that in the conditional. Item number five is the adoption of 462, Form 62. Oh, this is the new form required by the GEO, and this is the form that deals with bidders on city contracts or contracting within the city. I understand that this form is already similar to Forms 18 and 59. In reviewing this, this made a lot of sense in terms of a new form to administer the GEO. If my fellow commissioners have any questions.
No, I'll move to approve.
I'll second.
All right, all those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Approved. So thank you for your time. Minimum font size. Is this because everyone saw that I had to put on my glasses to see who was in the audience? Okay. All right, these are, as the executive summary says, technical amendments to the city's campaign finance ordinance to reflect recent changes in state law. I looked at this. This seems like not only does it make sense, but it seems like we need to comply with state law. I have no questions on this item, but if my fellow commissioners have any questions. All right. I would move to approve the amendments proposed in the report.
I'll second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Perfect. Item number seven, the audit policy. Approve, this deals with, this is a little meatier, actually. So this deals with changes. Do we have a public comment? This deals with some technical and substantive changes to the audit policy. I counted, I believe, 12 changes. I thought the definitional changes made a lot of sense. I had two or three questions on timing. But let me open it up to my fellow commissioners if they want to go first.
Yes, I had a question about the extension. The extension as proposed in this document is 180 days. As a prosecutor and a trial attorney, we often ask for extensions. I understand that, but I'm concerned that that period of time, which is 6 months, is a little bit extensive. If you could comment on that, please, Nathan.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, I'd like to point out that the newly proposed policy incorporates some amendments to the timelines themselves. One of the things that we're recommending is reorganizing the timelines generally so that they apply based on the size of the committee, the amount raised or spent. And we believe that incorporating those timelines, number one, is going to provide more flexibility for everybody involved in this process. We anticipate that that's going to be kinder to both those who are audited and those of us who conduct the audits. Secondly, I would also like to add that we are giving committees more time to respond to draft reports. So specifically, right now, committees have about 7 calendar days to respond to each draft report they receive per committee. We recognize that audits, when people are doing their audits, they don't necessarily do those on a committee basis one by one. You know, normally that this is going to be done concurrently. And the new policy reflects that. In fact, we recommend providing committees 21 calendar days specifically to respond to all draft audit reports. And because committees typically, participants typically have about 2 committees that they're auditing, this will give them the equivalent of the time allotted for 3 committees under the current standards. With regard to the extension for good cause up to 180 days, again, I would just like to emphasize that I believe that the newly proposed timelines will largely eliminate the need for those sort of extensions. Essentially, it's there just in case it's needed, because we recognize that the audit process necessarily involves a little back and forth. And this is good because the back and forth helps to ensure compliance and helps to ensure that things are done accurately as well as efficiently. And I would also like to add that there is a safeguard should there be any in Section D3 of the policy that would allow the staff, if there are any extenuating circumstances present, that the staff would exercise some discretion. So I think there are adequate safeguards in there as well.
Can I ask a follow-up question to that? If you don't have one.
Oh, I just have one more.
To this?
Yeah, just okay. One more on this. Is the application for extension, is that in writing or is that verbally? If someone seeks an extension, and who determines what good cause is?
Sure. Well, I think that the extension itself, it's written into the policy. That's, if you look at the specific section, I will point you to, which is C3C of the proposed policy in Attachment A on page 2, item 7. It says that for any committee, the completion date may be extended for good cause by the director of audits up to...
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
My follow-up question was just in terms of our staff. Heather, you might know, you may help as well. Our staffing capacity in audits, would we also feel, I know that in the past we've talked about, you know, having a lot of work and maybe not enough staff. So I was wondering if this also gives some leeway to staff, because I imagine with the tighter timelines, we might be able to get our campaigns or our committees to adhere to that, but we internally may not have the capacity to meet our own deadlines.
Yes, that is absolutely one of the considerations. We do have a very small audit staff, and the way the policy is currently drafted, it's very strict in terms of these deadlines must be met or otherwise someone is not able to be eligible for an early resolution of any audit findings. So we wanted to create the flexibility that we don't wind up, because of our limited resources, creating a situation in which someone who would otherwise qualify is not able to resolve early.
Okay.
Mr. Hardy, did you introduce yourself and tell us how the elevators are running before we even started here?
I didn't get a chance to introduce myself, but my name is Nathan Hardy. I'm the Director of Policy for the Ethics Commission. I'm pleased to report that the elevators are running smoothly, and hopefully no one will experience any hiccups today.
If you ever go on a roller coaster or airplane, I'd ask you to just alert me as to which roller coaster airplane that is.
Absolutely.
I had the same question that Commissioner Murray had about the 180 days. Mm-hmm. So the other all my questions were dealing with the timeline extensions.
Okay.
And it seemed to me that the extension under 2A and 2C were pretty kind of small and reasonable, but then the 180 days mm-hmm. also struck me as maybe longer than I had originally anticipated. But there is a requirement that that there's a showing of good cause, mm-hmm. and the requirement, how do we fulfill good cause in this situation?
How do we fulfill good cause in this situation? Well, I think that one is, we pointed out in response to Commissioner Murray's question, the director of audits is the one that has the discretion to determine which, you know, audits may need to be extended for good cause. I know that, and I think that's an adequate and I think balanced way of approaching it because, you know, the audit director and the staff, you know, completing these audits, they have a tremendous amount of expertise and experience conducting these audits. As far as good cause, this again, I think, is not going to be something that we anticipate becoming the norm. It's not something that we anticipate being necessarily used often, but it's there when it's needed.
I was just going to add, we have other provisions in our laws where we speak about good cause, and that's
the definition's imputed.
Exactly. Okay. And the reality is that Nathan is right, that this is considered something that's important for the outliers. When we have a $3 million campaign or a $5 million campaign, that's going to take some time.
And just to maybe provide some context, for how many members of the audit team do we have?
We have currently an audit team of four positions. One of them is vacant.
And how many committees do you process through the audit? Like roughly, I know that changes.
It varies from committee to or from election to election, depending on the competitive nature of the races. The 2013 elections, which we are still in the process of auditing, we have 87 committees to audit for that. For the 2015 elections, we have in the range of about 50.
And just from some of the election reports we've seen, like we're seeing a lot more people file to be candidates than we have in the past, and a lot of times they're smaller individuals who may not be as well versed or who can't afford, you know, treasurers who would be able to maybe file as accurately, and we've recently dealt with a similar situation with that. So I would just comment that I understand on paper 180 may look astounding, but, you know, when we started this meeting, we talked about how fast 2 months went, and with four people and the amount of committees I anticipate coming just in 2017, and I've seen some of, like, the preliminary lists of who's running, I think we can anticipate that I trust that staff is doing their best to expedite, but I understand that time is just time and workload is workload.
Yeah, thank you.
That's a good point. So Commissioner Ordon has been approved on consent, so she is officially our newest member of the commission as of 3 minutes ago, I understand. Okay, so those are very helpful points about timing. My last question about timing is, how often are there more than three committees being audited at the same time? Because I know we picked the 21 days, and you know, that would essentially be three committees because the time runs consecutively.
And I think for that question, we'll direct you to our Director of Audits, Eric Tan.
Eric Tan, Ethics Commission, Director of Audits. Yeah, normally we don't see that many audits relating to the same committee.
Okay.
On average, they have like two, and especially for those elected official, and when they're up for re-election, they have an additional like office holder committee. So if they go into like a runoff, you see three from the primary and the general and then the office holder. So you don't see that often three at the same time. Normally, just two.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I have a question.
Thank you.
This is in under the resolution of findings in D, item 2. It says the policy has the following requirements, and the participant must execute a written ERA agreement fully admitting all findings. Mm-hmm. What if they want to challenge one of the findings? Can they still settle everything else?
So if they want to challenge one of the findings, well, one of the important aspects of this, and I think it's important to emphasize that this is completely voluntary, but the purpose of this policy is to ensure that we're spending our limited staff resources on those cases that merit it, that involve significant or intentional misconduct. The audit policy is really designed to provide a way for people to resolve findings that are typically the result of inadvertent errors or oversights, and provide them a way to resolve those early outside of the enforcement process. And as part of that, one of the requirements to participate in that policy is that they admit any findings that are present. And they're eligible, under the proposed policy, they're eligible to participate in it as long as there are 10 or fewer findings under the proposed policy. So they are welcome to challenge that if they want, but if they do so, then they wouldn't be abiding by the policy. Again, they're fully welcome to do it because it's completely voluntary whether they choose to participate in an early resolution audit. But one of the requirements of that process is that they admit the findings, and if they would rather go through the enforcement process and challenge that, then they're certainly welcome to do so.
So if they challenged one, then all, let's say six, findings would go through enforcement?
Well, again, the policy specifically states, and this is the way it's currently set up as well, if you challenge one, then essentially that's you would be electing not to participate in that process.
But just to clarify, you're not proposing to change. That's existing language?
That's
so
existing.
If we had questions, so then would we be proposing a change if we had an issue with that?
Heather Holt, interjecting again. No, this is how the policy is currently structured. One change that we are recommending is allowing for a situation in which a audit does go through the enforcement process, and because of differing standards of proof between audits and enforcement, if enforcement winds up with fewer audit findings, then they can go back and then enter into an early resolution agreement at that point. But the short answer to your question is yes, as it stands now, and we're not recommending a change. It's agreeing to all or none. Yeah.
I just want to clarify.
I think my question might have been earlier. I was I'm just curious in general what kind of feedback, and what feedback or how have we, in leading to this, were there in our audit process, did we feel that this arose because of the audits that we were doing, and if there was any like anecdotal things that might put some more context into these recommendations, I think that would be helpful to understand.
Sure. One of the very real situations is a $3 million campaign. That, for the timeline purposes, that's just a lot of work for both the auditors and the committees being audited. We also have heard over the years that the policy has been in place that the payment structure, particularly for second-time agreements, was particularly high, and so we're recommending eliminating that escalation in payment amounts and maintaining consistency. Also, we're recommending that because as Nathan pointed out, that the eligibility criteria require a small number of what's essentially inadvertent oversights, mm-hmm. that a committee or a candidate be able to take advantage of the policy anytime that the candidate qualifies, and not limit that to just two audit cycles. But these, you're absolutely right. These are all things that we have learned having lived with the policy that's in place through the extensive audit cycle for the 2013 elections.
Thank you.
I have one last question on 2A, changing the timeline to 45 days and 60 days. Mm-hmm. Has anyone contended that they would be harmed by these changes? Or is there any fear that there'd be any harm by these changes?
Okay. Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. All right. I don't have any more questions on this. All of mine dealt with timing. Are there any other questions?
Oh, I just had one more.
Yeah.
As far as eligibility, you mentioned about the candidate training. That's already in place. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. And this is reinforcing for them?
Yes.
Right. Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Okay, so I would move to approve the updates by adopting the resolution in attachment A.
I'll second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All right, that is item number 7. For item number 8, Stacy.
No, Ms. Shin. No, isn't it him again?
Sorry? Oh, we have a public comment. Oh, yes, public comment, sorry.
Good morning, Commissioners.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you. As the Commission considers the dark money proposal, I wanted to take a moment to flag a few key differences between the proposal and what's already in place at the state level, and also flag a couple of items, practical implications as the regulated community would try to comply with these new requirements. The key differences really at the state level is that the top 10 list does not apply to general purpose committees as the proposal sets forth. And if you have in your top 10 donors a PAC donor at the state level right now, they require you to pierce through and disclose only the top 2 donors, not the top 10 donors of that PAC donor. More importantly, practically speaking, there are things that the Commission should consider, including if I, as a committee that would have to comply with this requirement, have to disclose my top 10 donors, one of which is a PAC donor, I think there could be problems trying to comply with that if you have, for example, the PAC, not all PACs file electronically, so one, I'm not sure how we would go about getting that information, and two, we'd really be in a position of relying on information and possibly be liable for and based on information that's provided by another committee. Just big picture, as you consider this proposal, I hope you'll consider the context that LA City already has a very robust disclosure requirement, especially compared to the state and some of the other jurisdictions, including the city requires a third pre-election where a lot of the big donors are already disclosed under a 24-hour report and a lot of your activities disclosed just immediately before the election. And more importantly, the city already requires the disclosure of your top 2 donors on disclaimers regardless of their contribution levels. Thank you.
If you could just maybe state your name and the organization you're representing, just for the record.
Sure. Stacy Shin, attorney at Kaufman Legal Group. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Harvey, welcome back. So these are proposals that deal with our disclosure regime, which, as it states in the beginning, is apparently something that I asked for in June 2014. And I understand that in order to frame our conversation, I want to say that this isn't about approving specific language. It's about conceptually approving what are we going to do moving forward. And I would say particularly because we have a new commissioner as of a few minutes ago who has a lot of experience, I think that that's a good idea for us to keep our eyes on the fact that this is a very important discussion, but one that I want a full panel to be here for. And my understanding in reading through this is essentially the statement that the state has taken the lead in trying to become one of the leaders in disclosing dark and gray money, which I know began after a well-publicized battle with the a ballot measure committee in November 2014 dealing with a kind of dark money group funneling money to, I think it was Prop 30 and 32. Mm-hmm. And since then, I think many of us have spoken to people at the FPPC, and it seems that their current regime is working well. And therefore, I think in general, it makes a lot of sense for us to follow the lead but not leap beyond the state, who's already... frankly, I think done a lot in this area. I know that this is an ever-changing area of the law and that the Supreme Court recently is in the habit of striking down limitations on how much we can give and spend, but is also in the habit of saying, in no uncertain terms, is very much in favor of campaign disclosure because that is where essentially the work and money in politics will be because it serves interests related to corruption and preventing corruption and the appearance of corruption and provides information to voters. So I think that it stands on strong constitutional footing. And thank you. So I'm interested to hear your responses to Ms. Shin. I have a couple of questions that essentially deal with how we pick the thresholds. Mm-hmm. And in framing our conversation, as I know my fellow commissioners already know, our elections are essentially going to be changing because we will be consolidating starting in 2020. And so our best guess is that elections are going to become more expensive. So I would say that when I was first looking at the numbers, frankly, it's my personal preference that we captured more of the activity through disclosure and or disclaimer requirements, but then in thinking about it, I realized in talking about it that we may actually capture virtually all of the activity once we have one very long ballot. So having said that, are you comfortable responding to Ms. Shin's 2 points? The 2 points that I am particularly interested in are the top 10 doesn't apply to general purpose committee, so I think it's mm-hmm. two on the state level. We're asking sure. for 10, and then the kind of administrability issues dealing with if one of the top 10 is a PAC. I know then we have this kind of like endless Russian doll shell game of trying to actually find someone, and I think there's, Ms. Shin mentioned some potential liability issues that they're essentially relying on the representation of other committees.
Well, wait, before that, can you just confirm that her characterization of, I'm not questioning Mrs. Shin, but I just want to make sure before we assume that what she presented was accurate, can you just address that first and then answer her questions? Because I just,
sure.
are we operating with the same information? It's a little
yeah, I don't think that the way Ms. Shin phrased her response or her comments was inaccurate.
Okay,
so.
Thank you.
And with that, I suppose if there are no additional questions, I'd be happy to jump in and respond to Mission's 2 points.
That'd be great.
So, first of all, I would like to just note that, again, as President Levinson, as you stated, that today we're approaching this from a conceptual point. So, number one, off the bat, I'd just like to say that I think that the concerns that Ms. Shin listed in our public comments, I think we can address those at the stage, perhaps at October's meeting, when we're actually looking at more specific language and having a more robust discussion about what that specific language should be and what it should look like. Secondly, I would just like to add that with respect to why we decided to include general purpose committees in this at all, one, the as you alluded to earlier, the United States Supreme Court has essentially said that disclosure is all we have, that it permits citizens and shareholders to react to the speech of corporate entities in a proper way because this enables voters to make informed decisions and give proper weight to different speakers and messages. We believe that this proposal and the state's proposal is a way to do that, to help voters make informed decisions, to help them see who's truly behind major campaigns in city elections. And we believe that based on the data that we've looked at, we've seen that general purpose committees are significant players here in city elections. The one thing that I think is great about the state's top 10 list is what it does is take largely information that's already publicly available, but helps voters connect those dots and do so in a quick, easy, transparent way that is easily understandable and easily accessible. I think it would be highly beneficial to the voters here in the city of Los Angeles to do that as well. But again, one of the reasons that we looked at this is in looking at the data in 2013 and 2015 for the city elections, we noted that in 2013, just slightly less than a third of all contributions reported by primarily formed and general purpose committees came from other committees themselves. In 2015, this actually rose to a level of nearly 58%. Accordingly, we thought it would be appropriate for the city to essentially add a top 10 disclosure requirement addressing this gray money issue. And just for the purposes of our conversation and all in attendance today, I think it's important to recognize that essentially dark money is a scenario in which you don't know where the money is coming from. Gray money speaks more to the situation where you're receiving, say, donations or contributions from committee to committee. So you know where it came from, but you don't necessarily know who's behind that committee. And the top 10 list is a great way of disclosing that to the public and informing them. To her point that the state only requires additional disclosure of the top two contributors to those listed on a top 10 list already, I think it's important to point out that state law already allows for the state to include additional disclosure up to 10 for that second layer of disclosure. So essentially what we're recommending is consistent, completely consistent with the Political Reform Act. And I think that's something that's important to keep in mind.
I would just add with regard to the concern about liability, I think that's an excellent point, and there should, in whatever language is approved, if we move forward with this and any form that is required, it should definitely state that what is being reported is only as good as what's reported by the committees at interest there.
And also just for context, do we have any... Have we identified any similar situation at the city level that would cause us to want to pursue this as well, like the state did? Did we have a situation, or do we not even know that we have situations because our laws don't allow us to even identify them?
I think it's likely more the latter. I think what President Levinson mentioned about the city moving to the in 2020 to the state and federal election cycle, we anticipate that one of the results of that could very well be that there will likely be more money coming from committees because essentially city candidates are going to be competing with state and federal candidates for funds. That's likely to make elections a little more expensive, and I think it's likely to increase the situation in which candidates will be relying on more committee money. And I think precisely why a proposal like this would be very, I think, helpful and informative to city voters.
We were also surprised by the data. We went into it thinking, we don't really have an issue here. I mean, the state law with dark money kind of covers the bases, and we really haven't seen gray money. But we were surprised by the percentage of contributions that do come from committees. So we do think that, and it has been on the rise in the two elections that we've had since Citizens United. So we do think that there's value in being proactive on that.
Thank you.
It has been on the rise. Okay.
The percentage of contributions from committees has risen from 2013 to 2015.
Because we had to, right. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So I think in general, my feeling is that these changes make a lot of sense, that I don't want to fall behind what's happening because I think that we can all see on the federal, state, and local level that there's just going to be more money, that it's going to be spent in more kind of complex and interesting ways that make it more difficult for the public to see what's happening. I would put a plug in for whatever resources are available to try and make our website as user-friendly and accessible as possible, because I know that the FPPC on the state level has been doing a good job of that, and I know that the FEC on the federal level has been, I think, kind of at the forefront of some fairly complicated open source et cetera, that I wouldn't even know how to finish the sentence of explaining exactly what that does. But I think increasingly that is the way that people will get information. As I said, my minor kind of questions and discomfort dealt with the thresholds, but I'm not comfortable kind of trying to redline this and saying that it should be moved lower at this point because, again, I think by the time it's implemented, we're going to have more elections that capture these... the spending. So my sense is that as a general matter to kind of conceptually approve this, that this makes a lot of sense, but I don't want to cut off any conversation.
Sure.
I want this to be the beginning of the conversation, not the end as well.
And I just want to make sure that I'm going to be more curious to see the language specifically to address what Heather already said, that the forms would clarify any liability on the PAC issue.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if when you come to us, will we see the sample form language? Okay.
Oh, sure. And yeah, and I think that's the advantage of addressing this conceptually today, because it does help start that conversation and help us reach consensus on what we want that proposal to look like. And of course, when we move into recommending more specific language, I think we'll be able to address those concerns.
All right. Commissioner Murray or Vice President Oberstein? Do we, any
I was going to reiterate my concern was on the $100,000 threshold, sure. And that's just a starting conversation. Okay, thank you.
Is the $100,000, is that in line with matching funds? If you receive matching funds from the city, or what, why was that chosen?
$100,000 is the same number as one of the maximums in the matching funds program, but it's different. It was based on the data that we collected from the 2013 and 2015 elections here in the city, based on the spending that was done by general purpose and primarily formed city committees in those elections and at what levels they tended to spend money in significant amounts.
Yeah. I would also just like to add that in addition to this, so number one, this was supported by the data that we looked at, as Heather mentioned. I think it's also important to add for context, since we just got through discussing the audit policy, that $100,000 is currently also the threshold at which city law requires an audit to be conducted of candidate-controlled committees. So we thought that was an appropriate threshold as well, at which to require disclosure of primarily formed and general-purpose committees, because essentially I think that says that, you know, there's a certain level at which voters, have a right to know about, you know, who's funding these campaigns.
I do have a question. I mean, I know it's not as prevalent, but I know that there's a big effort to try to get as many small donors, to try to get more money into politics, but at smaller levels. Mm-hmm. So if there was a grassroots committee that had maybe 20, like their top donor was $25 and everybody else was $5. Would we have some kind of limitation on that back end? Because I kind of feel like if you were the $25 donor, your name is going to come out on this list and people are going to now think you're, you know, what we usually assume would be like a $100 or $10,000 donor. There's a big difference between $25. So would our policy consider maybe saying if you're like, I think we do $99, right? Anything below $99, you don't get disclosed. So would we be able to put that into this policy so that if there was, what I hope would happen in the future, more small grassroots campaigns, those people don't feel like they're now being tagged with other people?
Yeah, sure. So, well, first of all, I'd just like to put, so currently our bottom floor threshold would be for that second layer of disclosure if you're on it. If you made it to a top 10 list and you had given, you were also a committee and you'd given $5,000 or more, that's the current floor that we have for that second layer of disclosure. I think to address your concern that you stated of, I think, someone being on that initial top 10 list, but maybe having, given a very small amount, I think that's something that we could address when we're looking at specific language. And I think.
I mean, and I open that up to the rest of the commission, too, if you feel like that's a valid. I don't want them to work on it if we don't feel like that's a valid point.
I think that's right, because top 10 kind of says to the world you're a big money player. And I think that Commissioner DeHaan is exactly right, that if you spend $26, you're really not. And so, what we're concerned, of course, is, I could see this, frankly, going both ways in terms of informational interest, but I think in terms of deterring corruption or the appearance of corruption, it's really nobody's going to buy a city election with $26. So if possible, I think that's a great idea, and if there can be some language that essentially says, like, if it's two figures, then maybe we're not particularly worried about you, that would be great. Okay, well, I would move to conceptually approve the recommended, I think it says gray money, but both dark and gray money disclosure requirements for further discussion. Any seconds?
I'll second.
All
right, all those in favor?
Aye.
Great. All right, moving on to item number 9, we have a number of public comments. I understand Birdsell has to go soon, so could we hear from you first?
Thank you for accommodating my schedule. I'm Regina Birdsell. I run the Center for Nonprofit Management here in Los Angeles. And as you think about item 9, one of the things that I wanted you to know is that we see about 4,000 nonprofit leaders every year that work on all those tough issues in LA. And since the recession, we've been asking them to talk to policymakers about what works and what doesn't. what I'm concerned about as you think about this is some of the big money issues that you're talking about is kind of the opposite of the problem that we have on the nonprofit sector, which is trying to get more out of the money that we have. So I was hoping that while you explore this, that if there was anything that we could do to help you hear from nonprofits about any potential consequence of these decisions that you may not understand, that we would be happy to help you get together with nonprofit organizations. So.
And Ms. Holt, is there a way for nonprofits to reach out to staff? Because I know that's a place where people can really get bang for the buck with the staff.
Absolutely. We welcome contact from anybody, nonprofits, anybody else who might be affected by the lobbying regulations to contact staff. We'd be happy to meet with you and hear specific concerns that you might want to raise.
Well, we'd be happy to convene a group, because we see thousands. So to get their perspective on anything that you're considering, we'd be happy to help with that.
Nathan Hardy is our director of policy. He's the guy to contact.
Not you.
Well, you can contact me, but he would organize it, yeah.
Absolutely. And I guess for the commission, they could just put their comments in writing like we've received today, and then the sooner we get them, the better, because then that gives us more time to digest them. So if you guys do convene and have some follow-up or identify some issues that you think we need to be brought to our attention, I think the best thing to get it to the commission would be to just submit it in writing and before our next meeting so that we have time to review it. And even better if you work with Mr. Hardy, because then maybe he can address it and it's already folded into what we consider.
Before we even look at anything, right.
Perfect. There's such confusion around lobbying and advocacy, and we're trying to make progress in that area, and the timing is just awkward. So,
do you know how to reach him?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Does that address? Okay.
That's
okay.
Thank you.
Great. Ms. Berlin.
Good morning, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak. And I'm a good follow up to Regina. I'm the policy director of California Association of Nonprofits, and we are a statewide membership organization. We have over 10,000 member organizations in the state, and we represent the interests of nonprofits at every level of government and in the community at large. Some of this you probably already know, but there are we did a study called Causes Count and Economic Impact Report on California's nonprofit sector in 2014, and some of what we collected in that was information on all nonprofits in California. There are about 6,100 nonprofits, 501c3s, in the city of Los Angeles, and that number is growing. They represent everything that you know. Many of them are grassroots groups. Most of them are small. They're food pantries and community choirs and pet rescues and everything else. And but our study also did an independent survey where we tried to figure out exactly what nonprofits do as part of their mission. And we discovered that most nonprofits, 60-plus percent, engage in some sort of advocacy. They do research and public education, but they also meet with public officials. And they mostly do it at the local and city level. Mm-hmm. So the discussions that you're having around this are particularly germane to what nonprofits do. But the problem is that for most nonprofits, although they're very, very aware of their federal requirements, lobbying requirements, they probably are pretty unaware of city requirements or that there are actually any city rules at all. I would be most honest about that. And so that's where we become very interested in this, because, of course, we want all of our nonprofits to do the right thing. And so we would like to make sure that they're able to do that by being as informed as possible. And so my hope for you in going forward in this process that you're in is to have as an inclusive and robust process as possible that includes all of the nonprofits who want to be involved in this process. Whether it's in informational hearings or it's in some kind of discussion groups or whether it's a working group. But there needs to be some way to do that outreach to bring everybody in. And as Regina Birdsall said, we also at California Association of Nonprofits would be happy to help in any way that we can to make sure that that outreach is done and those public convenings happen so that you get that kind of input.
So I'm hearing a pattern, and
I think that it would be really useful, Mr. Hardy, for there to be some, I think on the staff level, because frankly so many things are worked out before, as everybody knows, before they get to us. And certainly everybody's always welcome to come and share their concerns with us. But before it even gets to the point where you need to try and rectify something, let's just try and make sure that it's, we have input from everyone who wants to give input in the first instance. So
and
thank you very much.
Also, just to clarify, and I just want to make sure I'm understanding the comments. So the comments have been mostly focused on concerns that 501c3s would not be aware of the requirements, not so much that there's specific concerns with the policies we have before us today?
Yes, because they wouldn't even know that you have the policies before you today. That's precisely the problem. So it's really both.
And I'll just, I mean, we recently had a situation where we had a stipulation with a nonprofit who had concern, or who inadvertently hadn't met some of our requirements. And I think what came out of that and has come out in a lot of our stipulations is always, unfortunately, you know, ignorance of the law doesn't mean that we don't have to comply. And so I think what I'm hearing is, separate and apart from the policy we're considering today, we should focus on outreach to nonprofits, and it sounds like there's two organizations before us today, so that we can train people with the policy, whatever that policy may be. But at the end of the day, obviously, it's on the 501c3's responsibility to become aware of their obligations under the law.
That's right. We're totally aware of that. We understand that. We promote that. We have a compliance checklist on our website. We do workshops on compliance, but we know that it's hard to do that without more of a collaboration.
Great.
Exactly.
Ms. Berlin, can I ask an additional clarifying question?
Sure.
On top of Commissioner DeHaan? Is the concern not also that it would hinder nonprofits' ability to then advocate because they would somehow be not complying with the law?
Right. We hear that from our nonprofit members all the time, that they're afraid to get up and speak because they don't know what the rules are. They're hard to understand even if you get copies of them. And so they aren't sure whether they can speak up on an issue or not, so they don't speak at all. And so for this to be as clear as possible with as much outreach as possible means that more of our nonprofits can feel confident in the advocacy that they do.
Great. Thank you very much.
You.
I just want to apologize in advance for my pronunciation. Shyam Subramanian. You can start by explaining. From the Alliance for Justice.
Yes, my name is Shyam Subramanian, and I'm Southern California Counsel with Alliance for Justice. Thank you for the opportunity to comment today. I just wanted to echo the comments Nancy and Regina made about the need for outreach to nonprofit organizations. At the Alliance for Justice, we're an association of over 115 national organizations, and we provide legal support to hundreds of LA area nonprofits, including and especially 501c3 organizations, on the rules of advocacy, including the City of Los Angeles's lobbying disclosure rules. And to educate nonprofits, we develop trainings and also plain language materials. And in our experience, as was mentioned before, there is a lot of uncertainty, and sometimes full-time employees of 501c3s are unaware of the lobbying disclosure rules, especially if they're not full-time lobbyists and advocate before the city as part of their organizational responsibilities. So we would just request, as part of the review process, targeted outreach to the 501c3 organizations in the city, as well as a special hearing for these organizations to hear their input. And we think that this would really be a good way to solicit input from them on their unique role in shaping city policy and to solicit their input. So, again, I want to thank you for the opportunity to comment today.
Thank you very much. Okay. Sorry, I can't read the first letter. UN Noon?
When?
Good morning, Commissioners. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you. My name is Ewan Nune, Staff Counsel at
Thank
Public
you.
Counsel. Public Counsel is a public interest law firm representing over 250 nonprofits in LA County. We work to develop the capacity of underserved and low-income communities by providing free legal and capacity-building services to these nonprofit organizations. I just wanted to take the opportunity today to thank the Commission for its efforts to preserve the robust exemptions for 501c3 organizations, which is consistent with our position in previous comments that we had issued way back in January of 2009. We look forward to further discussions on this matter, and we intend to monitor this closely. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, I'm glad that so many representatives from nonprofits are coming, and I think everybody on the commission, and I hope I speak for the staff as well, welcomes these more detailed discussions, and I think that it will make for much better proposals when it comes to that.
So just to clarify, our timeline right now would be our next meeting, we would actually look at specific proposal language, right, depending on today? No?
No, this is actually, we're kind of in for the long haul on this. We're going to have a series of meetings that are just conceptual in nature, and then once we've decided conceptually on all of the aspects of the lobbying ordinance, then we'd come back with specific language. So we're looking at months of discussion. Yeah.
So based on kind of what we're hearing now, would it make sense then maybe we should have a comeback conceptual on this 501c3 specific issue that people are raising?
We could, although I think some of what Mr. Hardy will talk about might alleviate some of the concern, because we are actually recommending that the current exemption be preserved and expanded so that it would apply to more 501c3s than it currently does.
Okay, the only reason I'm kind of pausing is because it seems like at the end we're all going to be on the same page, but it seems like the feedback we got from some organizations is that they're not that aware of what we're doing yet, so they may not know that we're all going to get to a happy place. So I'm wondering if we could just align our timelines so that when we are at the happy place, they're there with us too.
Yes, absolutely. And we have done extensive outreach about this process already, which is the fact that so many people are here to be able to comment is a you know, affirmation of that. But we will continue to do that, and we'd love to hear from them about ideas they have for further engaging their constituencies. Okay. Yeah.
Ms. Pritchard.
Good morning, commissioners. I'm here really just to reinforce what you've heard from the other speakers. My name is Michelle Pritchard, and I am the director of the Common Agenda Program at the Liberty Hill Foundation, which has been serving Los Angeles for 40 years to advance really a broad social justice mission across many issue areas. We do this through grants, through training and capacity building, through convening organizations around public policy issues from time to time. And really, just to echo what you've heard from the others, we feel we have provided trainings. The foundation has done that, both using the resource of Alliance for Justice, the Kauffman Legal Group, but it is still our sense that there's a high level, or rather a very low level of awareness and confusion, a lot of confusion around the existing rules. So we want to urge compliance where there is lack of clarity around certain definitions. We think it would be really useful to have the kind of dialogue and in-depth discussion that others have recommended. So we just wanted to, I did provide a letter. I got it into the file late last night, but it looks like most of you have seen that. So we wanted to simply support having an in-depth public hearing geared towards the 501c3 sector. I should also add that as an active member of the philanthropic community here in Los Angeles, there's growing interest in helping nonprofits to really engage around public policy. So I think it's just going to be an expanding area and one that we really should devote the time to get right. So
I have one question, ma'am. In your letter, you spoke of the high cost of registration fees. Can you address that issue?
Well, the lobbyist fee, as I recall, is $450, for an employer lobbyist. The organization also has to pay. You know, for many of the organizations that we support, which are small and grassroots, it's a barrier, just to be really honest. I know it doesn't seem like a lot when you think about all the work that you have to do, but that's just one example.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you very much
thank
for
you.
Being
yes,
here.
Thanks for the time.
All right. Mr. Previn, item number 9.
Good morning, Ethics Commission. It is Eric Previn from Studio City, and I'm very interested in lobbying, and I'm very pleased that there's a new guy, Mr. Hardy. I've seen some of his work on today's agenda, and he's working diligently but quickly, and I'm glad that we're gonna listen to his thoughts and review them, and I think it's great that members of the not-for-profit community have come down to raise some concerns. I have some concerns as well. Not-for-profit is defined as a 501c3, and I like the way that it's, if they are trying to lobby on behalf of the advocacy they're doing for people who are in desperate need, they should be given kind of a small exemption. But there are large not-for-profits, as we all know, who roll really big and play big boy baseball. And I just don't want this to be yet another opportunity to have a little report on how much more influence we're getting from these groups that's going kind of exempt or unreported. Now, we're going to get to the bottom of it. That's the good news. This is finally a little bit of a transparency piece, and I do like that. Also in here, though, was how do we define there are a lot of terms that were defined. I believe that's the name of the item, defining the lobbyist terms. The central question is, what is a lobbyist? You know, and other jurisdictions, I thought, defined it similarly. And, you know, I took note that for our definition, you need to engage, and this is what's being proposed, I believe, in 30 or more compensated hours of lobbying activity to be considered a lobbyist. Anything less, correct me if I'm wrong, you're not a lobbyist. But that is a lot of work. I mean, so in other words, if I just came in as a specialist like Mr. Previn, I only take 3 minutes, but imagine if I had 15 hours to get into something. You know, you would want me to disclose that if I were taking money to get it done, I think. So I just think we have to be cautious. Others define it completely, anyone who receives compensation of any kind, you know. So that's a kind of a standard that the guys in the back don't like at all, because then they can't slip in little helpers. So that's something to seriously consider. Chicago also defines the three buzzers for Mr. Previn. That's a sign of respect in some cultures. The legislative administrative matter is kind of the benchmark. You know, anything that the council is going to approve or weigh in on is considered something that you don't want. But they have something which is also anything determined by an elected or appointed official. And that opens up a whole other can of worms that I think we would like to see with maximum transparency. So that said, the top 10 list in lobbying that we have has not worked at all. The numbers keep getting bigger and bigger. The rich keep getting richer and richer, and nobody knows about it, despite the seasonal article in the newspaper that says, well, no, they don't even say. Nobody knows that Englander Kanami Allen is the number one or number two every single time, and they can't connect the dots that Mitch Englander, a council member, and Matt Kanabi, the son of a supervisor, are related to that firm because it's just in the bowels of our catalog of records. So disclosure is good, but we also have to get the word out. And that's why Heather, in this new era, is going to do as much as she can to bring forward those kinds of plans. And thank you for your support.
All right. Thank you for your time. We have one more public comment on item number 9. Mr. Hertz.
Thank you. Good morning. Bradley Hertz of the Sutton Law Firm, and here today on behalf of the Los Angeles Lobbyist Association, which is a trade association of lobbying and public affairs professionals in the Los Angeles area. As an aside, I don't think I've ever heard lobbying laws and happy place in the same sentence, but we'll go with that. As we wrote in our letter of yesterday, we're pleased with the direction that Mr. Hardy and Mr. Lowe have taken this initial phase in terms of definitions, in terms of the transparency of the process, and we agree with the guiding principles and several of the new proposed definitions. We do, however, on behalf of the association, have some concerns. One is that that there be an exploration of whether the threshold should be different for in-house lobbyists who are employees of businesses, unions, or nonprofit organizations as compared to contract lobbyists. The compensation test makes sense when it's a contract lobbyist, in our view, but if it's an in-house employee on a salary, there may very well be a disparate impact when a CEO, as opposed to a lower-level employee, spends time and has to calculate a percentage of their salary there's going to be an inequity there in how much time is spent before the lobbying threshold is met. So we just think there should be acknowledgement of that difference and maybe look at different definitions that might meet that. Secondly is we want to make sure that the appropriate number and quality of exemptions are included when we get to that point. We've attached the San Diego and San Francisco applicable portions of their laws, and they have, not that we're counting, but about 19 or 20 categories of exemptions for those who testify at public meetings, those who are involved in adjudicatory proceedings, those who merely are technical, like geologists, et cetera. And finally, we think land use planners and others should be looked at in their own category. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. That's really helpful. I really appreciate the feedback on this issue, and I think lobbying is one of the more complicated and important areas. I think that this is our last big review before I assume we then start another review, because they always take so long in our endless review. And so for everyone who spoke, it really enhances our ability to think about these issues, and I know that Mr. Hardy has more than enough work ahead of him. So for now, I would say that this is an action item, but what we're asked to do is essentially, again, just kind of conceptually approve, this makes sense, please move forward. We're not approving any specific language. At this point, I think, a lot of what I saw here makes sense in terms of changing the threshold from time to money. I think that, the charts are helpful in terms of how many people we actually capture here. And I would say that I'm loath to get into too many details because, I think that we could have an interesting discussion. I think that the details might change once you have hearings with members of the public and stakeholders and people who do this on a daily basis and have concerns. So, my feeling is that we should definitely ask any questions that we have with the understanding that this may change.
I actually did question changing from the hours to the amount, just because having had some experience working in the government affairs, and I definitely agree with one of the letters that we received about that 2,000 kind of being disparate, being different between, the higher paid employees who do this work versus, people who just kind of do some of the technical stuff that don't necessarily do what I think lobbying is supposed to capture, right? So a lot of, that's one point. But, so I wanted to get more information about that change and what drove that in the 2,000 so that I can understand the perspective guiding this.
Sure. First and foremost, I think it's important to point out that the two letters we've received regarding the compensation standard actually supported the $2,000 compensation-based threshold. I know there are some concerns about whether we should do a different standard for in-house lobbyists, and I'd be happy to discuss that as well and why we arrived at our recommendation. At the outset, I think it's really important to emphasize that going back to 1967, the city of Los Angeles has historically defined who a lobbyist is on the basis of compensation for lobbying services. That was the case when the city passed its first lobbying ordinance in 1967. It was the case in 1994 when the municipal lobbying ordinance was first adopted. It changed in 2007. However, in our administration of the laws and also just soliciting feedback from the public, from the regulated community, one of the things that we've noticed is that the current hourly threshold really poses both a compliance and an enforcement challenge. One of the reasons for that is not all organizations keep track of these hours, and so may not have that ready at hand. Another concern is just from an accountability standpoint that it can be really difficult for staff to prove that someone's met that hourly threshold, which in turn makes it more difficult to ensure that everybody's playing by the same set of rules. And I know that's one of the concerns in particular that we've heard from the regulated community and people who do lobby the city, because that is something that is a fine activity. It's not something to be demeaned, or, you know, lobbying is a First Amendment right. One of the things that our law recognizes and tries to do is, you know, ensure that those regulations are reasonable. And one of the things that we frequently hear from the regulated community is that, you know, hey, I register, I play by the rules, but, you know, I see some guys at these meetings, they're clearly lobbying the city, but they're not registering. And we think one of the reasons for that is the hourly threshold, which we think that moving, returning to the city's historic use of a compensation-based standard will both help to ensure compliance and also ensure greater transparency and accountability.
So then the $2,000 came from, like, that specific amount.
Oh, okay.
Because I feel like $2,000 doesn't match with what 30 hours would be, if that makes sense, right?
Oh,
so I feel like that's kind of what I don't understand. So 30 hours or more, if you take I don't know what an hour, I mean, I know lobbyists make a lot an hour, so $2,000 definitely is probably not covering that. And then if it was intended to capture a lot of in-house people, well, then I think that would be more of a reasonable amount. But so that's why the $2,000 kind of stood out to me, because it feels like, I don't know what a lobbyist, like, what would they make, like, on the low end, like, a couple hundred dollars, and on the high end, maybe, like, $1,000. So that's just maybe 2 hours of work for them, right? Versus we used to allow them to do 30 mm-hmm. over a three-month period.
Well, with respect to how we arrived at the $2,000 figure specifically, one of the things we looked at is the data about how much firms are reporting, receiving, and compensation. We also looked at how much clients are spending in a given year. We looked at data from the last year in 2015, and we saw that moving to a standard of $2,000 will, we think, again, help to ensure compliance and enforceability and in turn fortify public accountability. But one of the other things I think that is an added benefit of moving to a $2,000 threshold is that it has the benefit of aligning the city's lobbying disclosure threshold with the campaign finance laws. Currently, California state law says that, you know, if you're spending $2,000 in an election, the public has a right to know about those activities. And essentially it says that, you know, it's a level of significance at which we consider important enough to say that the public has a right to know. We think that it makes sense because both sets of laws, lobbying and campaign finance, serve to inform the public about who's spending money to try to influence government action. We believe that those standards should mirror each other, and we think that's an added benefit as well. And lastly, I would just add that establishing a standard of $2,000 reflects our historic view that not every person engaged in lobbying activity should be subject to regulation, recognizes that there should be a balancing. And in looking at the data that we proposed on page 4 of item 9, just showing the different lobbying firm compensation ranges, I think one of the overwhelming points that you'll take away from that is that, by and large, establishing a $2,000 threshold standard is likely not going to have much of an effect on those who are currently registered as lobbyists, but I think what it will do is clarify who should and shouldn't be reporting. And ultimately, that's, I think, what any good balanced threshold will do.
I guess I'll just respond. I do appreciate your explanation on the hours versus 2,000, and I think that I think that's a really valid point, that it makes it easier to comply. I'm still not 100% sold on the 2,000 mark, just because I think there's a big difference in, you know, giving money to get somebody elected is different to me than, you know, the lobbying that I think most people do. And having been involved, both working, you know, for an elected official and then also working at a nonprofit trying to, you know, advocate for an issue, just $2,000 is not realistic. I mean, I just think that's a really, really low threshold, and I think that I understand the purpose of lobbying, and I think that we want transparency, but I think that there's a lot of advocacy work that gets done that I know counts as lobbying, but really it's like informing our elected officials. Unfortunately, our elected officials have to make a lot of decisions on information that they don't have an expertise on, and sometimes it is through lobbying that they get accurate information, and that's just sadly, I think, the reality of how decision-making happens. And so I just want to make sure that we don't limit expertise from getting to our elected officials when they make decisions. And I do want there to be transparency, but I just don't want it to be so overwhelming that or scary that people who would otherwise have engaged in a conversation just don't because it seems too burdensome.
Sure. Well, I think it's important to, in noting those concerns and addressing them adequately, I think it's important to just point out for context that regarding a threshold of $2,000, one, again, it reflects the city's historic view that, you know, this should be based on a compensation standard. Two, I would just point out that other jurisdictions, including New York City, apply a compensation standard across the board. In New York City, their compensation definition is the definition is broad, but registration is required at a point of $5,000 on an annual basis. And we think that $5,000 we thought would be a little high for the city of Los Angeles when we looked at the data, because we want to ensure that, one, you know, we want to make sure that it's reasonable what we're proposing. But we also want to make sure that it's capturing the level of activity that historically we've deemed that's important. And looking at who qualifies under the current hourly threshold, one of the things that we really took away was that the 2,000 mark really seemed to hit the nail on the head, so to speak, as far as being well-balanced and accurate and making sure that we're not losing anything when we move to a compensation-based standard. We certainly don't want the public and residents of the city to lose out on any information on who's trying to lobby the city, who's trying to spend money to influence government action. With respect to the concerns about the advocacy work, I think those are legitimate, and I would like to emphasize that today is just the beginning. It's this the first of many discussions, and I was certainly pleased to hear from all the feedback from the representatives from the various nonprofit organizations. I think they'll be pleased to know that one of the things we're recommending in this proposal is a categorical exemption for nonprofits that provide social service, human services at less than market value. That's a slight expansion regarding the current categorical exemption that is in place. So I think they'll be pleased to know that we're actually recommending expanding that slightly. I would also just like to note that as far as the other concerns, which I think are inherent in your concerns about advocacy and lawmakers getting information, because that is a legitimate need, I think it's also important to emphasize that regarding the broader list of exemptions that may very well apply when we arrive at a greater consensus around these issues, is that today we're just discussing what's in our current report represents what we believe should be categorical exemptions, people that should be completely exempt from the provisions of the municipal lobbying ordinance. However, other activities that people have noted, such as testifying at a public hearing, other suggestions like that, you know, those are things that we're going to look at down the road. So this is certainly not intended to be the only discussion of that issue. Really, this is just to start that process. And I think that moving to a compensation-based threshold will, encourage greater compliance, make it clear who's subject to the law and who shouldn't be. I think it will be more transparent and provide better disclosure to the public. But I think also it's important to emphasize, because this is just the beginning, this is just the first of several conversations, that I think we can address those concerns about providing information, various things, types of activities that perhaps should be exempt from those provisions. We can address those at later meetings, as well as concerns regarding registration fees and things of that nature.
So I'm definitely in support of moving towards compensation, and we don't have to continue discussing it. I don't have it at this point for the 2,000, but I will say before I can vote to support the 2,000, I would like to see more of that data, because what I heard you say is that most of the lobbying kind of far exceeds that. So if we raised it a bit, I still feel like we're going to capture a lot of it. And I've seen our lobbying reports, and it tends to be the same big people, and it's same, you know. And so I think, so to get me a 2,000, I'd have to see data that shows that, you know, if we didn't do 2,000, we were going to lose a big amount of people. But I think if we went a little higher, we'd still be okay. And it sounds like New York's been fine at 5,000. So even that already seems like it could be something we can start off at.
Well,
so that's all I'm saying. We'll look at that. When we come with a specific number, that's just so you know, that's where I'm going to be looking. In the same way you convinced me to go on the compensation way, I could very likely be convinced to do 2,000, but I'm going to need more information on that data.
We need to get to our happy place, Mr. Hardy. It's ultimately on you.
Well, that's where, you know, that's what we're here to do today.
I just want to echo Commissioner DeHaan's concern, and I would love to see data on how we went from $4,000 in compensation a quarter to $2,000 for the year.
Sure.
Before I would be willing. And I have another question. So when we're looking at the exemptions for nonprofits that provide life assistance to underserved clients, is that direct service, or would that be civil rights sort of overarching policies? Because I know a lot of the advocacy that gets done, mm-hmm. there are no programs that organizations necessarily have in place, but they are they're advocating for communities that would be directly affected by policies change. Sure.
Well, I'm glad you pointed that out. One of the things, again, as you point out, in our current recommendation, which is modifying the exemption so that it applies to any 501c3 organization that provides basic life assistance directly to disadvantaged individuals, either free of charge at a below market rate or based on their income or ability to pay. I think one of the rationales underlying that that proposal is that we don't want to penalize groups. Say, for instance, I know we had a speaker from Public Counsel, and I know one of the things that they do is provide services to indigent clients, but I believe organizations like them often charge a minimal fee as a result of that, and there are good reasons to do so. We wouldn't certainly want to discourage that sort of activity, that's good social activity, and we don't think that necessarily that specific type of work or advocacy should necessarily fall within the scope of the city's lobbying laws. So I think to address your question more directly, I would say our current language and proposal concerns organizations that provide this assistance directly to this group of individuals. But I think that as far as your kind of overarching concerns and big picture concerns about that type of advocacy, I believe could it be addressed when we're, you know, looking at more specific language down the road.
Okay, great. I'm thinking about, for instance, in the past, we were looking at a $15 an hour living wage for the city, and maybe it would have the implications of impacting those people who are underserved, but maybe those organizations aren't necessarily providing a direct service on a day-to-day basis like Public Counsel.
Well, I think it's also important to keep in mind that issue advocacy can constitute lobbying, and nonprofit organizations are currently subject to the lobbying ordinance. We do have a categorical exemption that some of them meet. We are recommending expanding that slightly. And as I think Heather mentioned, I'm certainly happy to meet with these groups, to have discussions, or to meet with anyone, for that matter, to discuss these laws. But I think one of the also important concerns that we have is to make sure that those who are expending significant sums of money, whether it's for what we might deem a good cause or a bad cause, I think it's important to ensure that the laws apply equally to all players. And so I think your concern about issue advocacy, I think some of that, I have to say, looks a lot like lobbying in a certain context. But, you know, of course, it would really just depend on the specific group issue, what you're talking about.
Okay. And just one more. So let's say we moved forward with this language, and you said the threshold was $2,000. How does that sort of manifest? How would it affect nonprofits? Would they would then have to register as a lobbyist, do reporting? Would they then also have to change their overall or add an additional tax ID? So would they become a 501c4 as well?
Well, first of all, I would like to again emphasize the conceptual nature of the recommendations that we're proposing today. So I think, for the most part, a lot of these concerns are going to be addressed at future meetings, and it's impossible to address it completely in one meeting. And that's why we have these discussions. That's the purpose of these meetings. I think that as far as 501c3 organizations and nonprofit groups, again, we are recommending a categorical exemption that would be slightly larger in scope than the one we currently have in place, which I think would be good news for those who are interested in that. I also, though, think it's important to emphasize that if you're lobbying on a matter and you reach that compensation threshold, it's important that the laws apply equally to everyone, so that we're not singling groups out, and so that we're making sure that everybody's playing by the same set of rules, regardless of who's funding those efforts.
Shireen, I think to answer your question, I think what you're getting to is I think that in general 501c3s have a limitation on their advocacy. Mm-hmm. So I think it's separate and apart from our rules. So if anything, this might just provide more transparency for them in terms of their own 501c3 tax compliance. But I do think what you're raising is oftentimes I think 501c3s are more like conveners, and they act to, get individuals who wouldn't otherwise have access to elected officials or understanding of issues. And so I think, I guess our questions are kind of around, okay, so we understand if they're directly advocating for something and that's going to benefit a program that they have, but let's say in general they care about, as Serena mentioned, this $15 wage increase, minimum wage increase. If they were letting their members know, helping set up meetings, but at the end of the day, was there individual members who showed up and spoke to that elected official, or they collected the letters and then they mailed in the letters? Or on the flip side, they distributed the address and told people who they needed to contact. Would that qualify as lobbying under our policy?
Well, first of all, I think if you go back to if you go to the report and if you look at in our definitions on page 5 of item 9, where we propose a new definition for the definition of lobbying organization, our laws currently refer to entities as in-house lobbyist employers, or termed just that, lobbyist employers. And we also have an entity under the current law called major filer. Now, currently, major filer refers to persons who spend at least $5,000 in a calendar quarter to attempt to influence a city matter through public relations, media relations, public outreach, and similar activities of that nature. Because the MLO expressly provides that the citizens of the city have a right to know the identity and interests that attempt to influence decisions of city government and the means employed by those interests, these persons are both already subject to the laws as they speak.
Could you clarify who these persons are?
Sure. So I'm talking about the major filer provision currently in the city's municipal lobbying ordinance.
But in the scenario I gave you, would that be the nonprofit? Is that who you're referring to?
Yes.
So the nonprofit who spends its money organizing its members or individuals or whoever, citizens, to come speak, they would then qualify under this provision?
So under this provision, yes. What we are proposing is that if you spend $2,000, whether you're a corporation, a nonprofit organization, or just a person, if you're spending $2,000 on media relations, public relations, advertising, things of that nature, to influence a city matter, if you're going to spend that level, we think it's fair that if we're going to subject lobbyists to a $2,000 threshold, that those entities should be required to register as lobbying organizations. because essentially that's what lobbying is attempting to influence a city matter. And again, the current provisions in the MLO and the principles that are enumerated in Section 48, 4801B speak to the guiding principles of the laws, and those persons are currently subject to the law if they spend $5,000. They would be a major filer under our current provision. We're simply recommending that we reterm that in a more streamlined and intuitive approach by defining a lobbying organization to include both in-house, both organizations that employ lobbyists in-house and persons who spend a certain amount of money in an attempt to influence city action. So spending, you know, $5,000, for instance, on a Raise the Wage campaign, spending $5,000 on a campaign to get tax breaks or any related matter, any attempt to influence a city matter that meets that, you know, spending threshold, we would deem that activity that should be categorized under the provision of what we call a lobbying organization. And one of the reasons that we differentiate that and we believe it makes sense to group these two groups together is that, in contrast to lobbyists and lobbying firms that receive money to influence action, lobbyist employers and major filers spend money to influence action. We believe it's appropriate, therefore, to treat them similarly as lobbying organizations.
When I think about the $15 an hour wage or a lot of other sort of equity issues, they're ongoing issues, they're mm-hmm. ongoing conversations. I guess my concern is if that's not the crux and the core focus of an organization and most of their efforts are focused on education or convening, surely someone like an organizer in an organization who's bringing people together over the course of a year is going to make $2,000 in their salary. Would they then, an organizer who is definitely not in what I think of in the category of lobbyists, would they then be forced to register?
I'll just jump in here and say that that person would only be required to register if, in addition to doing the organizing and earning $2,000 in a year, also had a direct contact with a city official in an attempt to influence that particular matter. So that person, if someone is simply behind the scenes at an organization and they're being paid to send out communications to members and that kind of thing, that would not qualify unless that person also had a direct contact with a city official.
Does that contact include calling their scheduler and scheduling the meeting for?
No, and I think Nathan has mentioned this, that we haven't put in front of you yet exempted activities. We've okay. only presented categorical exemptions, but ministerial actions like okay. scheduling a meeting, that would not be considered included.
Okay, I mean, I guess the only, so the same way I was questioning earlier, like, and I asked for that exemption for people who give $25 and that would make them the top 10, I also feel like, you know, part of why the public wants lobbying is because they feel like there's this money allows a certain group of people to have more influence in our decision-making process and in our government. And I feel, unfortunately, when you don't have those resources as an individual, then your best way of accessing government and having influence is through some kind of, leveraged grouping. And I think 501c3s operate to do that. I also know and believe that people have taken advantage of 501c3 laws. I also know that there are some, I think our public speaker, Eric Previn, mentioned that there are some really major nonprofits that probably go above and beyond and than what we're thinking about. So I will just say that this may also go back to that space of the 2000 where I was concerned about, where I thought, okay, so maybe we'll keep these definitions, but maybe we'll try to use the 2000 to allow some nonprofits who do this work but not at that large scale, you know, to have a little bit of space to do what I think is important, which is, you know, leverage the small groups of people who don't otherwise have a voice unless they come together. And unfortunately, coming together always costs money.
Sure. Yeah, and I understand that. And I will just add for the record that I myself have been an organizer before. So I completely understand the angle that you're coming from. And I think it's important just to say for clarity at the outset that, you know, we're not trying to these proposals aren't intended certainly to capture especially the minor, the small scale grassroots activity. What we're trying to do is one, make sure that everybody has subject to the same set of rules. We want to make sure that our suggestions and policy proposals are reasonable. We want to make sure they're balanced. We want to make sure they're fair. And we also want to make sure that if groups are spending significant amounts of money to influence city action, we think the public has a right to know about that. One of the things that you alluded to, and Mr. Previn alluded to, is that there are certain nonprofit groups who have, you could argue, abused some of those rules. And that's one of the reasons that the state ended up passing some of the legislation that it did regarding dark money, because there were groups essentially hiding money and funneling it through different channels to avoid public disclosure. And we want to make sure, one, that we're not creating those sort of loopholes or bad incentives in our lobbying laws, but more importantly, to just capture that, you know, if you're engaged in a specific, in a significant amount of spending money, if you're spending a significant sum of money, we think the public has a right to know that. That's fully consistent with the provisions and guiding principles enumerated in the law itself. And we believe that this is a good proposal that will improve upon the current provision, the major filer provision, and bring it into a more intuitive label, a more streamlined definition, and help clarify as to who's subject to the law and who's not. I think one of the things that I hear repeatedly coming up in this discussion in the public comments, I think will largely be addressed when we discuss the definition of lobbying activities. And one of the reasons that we decided to go with a conceptual meeting here to begin this first conversation is just to try to reach some consensus around who's a lobbyist, who's a lobbying firm, what's a lobbying organization. And then once we achieve that consensus, I think then at that point it would make more sense to really work and see, you know, what should constitute the definition of lobbying activities.
Yeah, I agree. And I think we're just giving you feedback. And I think we're all on the same page conceptually, but I think the devil's in the details. Sure. And I think that there's some seems like there's some concern about nonprofits. And so in what you presented, I'm seeing two ways in which we might address. One would be maybe the $2,000 amount. And then the other for later, because we haven't seen any specifics, will be towards the fees, right? So I think we all agree there should be transparency, but then there's that barrier. If they're going to have to register as a lobbyist and it's going to be $450, and then all the costs of tracking and hiring counsel for, you know, or whoever it is that advises them on their filing of their reports, those are extra costs that this nonprofit's now taken. So just something to be aware of. Sure. And when we look at that next aspect of the process, how can we'll allow for transparency, but maybe we'll have some kind of tiered something else that addresses this issue that I think we've heard everybody raise.
Sure. And we are happy. I think it's sufficient to say I'm excited. I think we're excited to begin this discussion now and recognize that this is going to be the first of many discussions, and we're certainly happy to address those issues.
And sorry, I know we spent a lot of time on the 501c3s. I do want to say that I am interested in the land use issues, only because, and I'll just disclose, I just purchased a house that's on city property, and I know we have a homeowners association, and we've had some issues that we're going to have to talk to the city about. And so I think, I'm just curious to see what activities if our association had to hire a lobbyist to get us access to be able to address some like technical issues on our property. That just raised an issue to me, and I didn't even know that was an issue. So I would be curious to see. I think there's a difference between, like, homeowners having an issue with their property versus, like, a developer, right? And so I don't know enough to know about the land use process, but that triggered something in my mind. So I just wanted to know if that was an issue I should be worried about as a citizen and property owner in the city of Los Angeles.
Absolutely not. No worries. but we do appreciate Mr. Hertz's offer to facilitate conversations about that particular issue. That will be very helpful.
Thank you.
Okay. I don't have any more questions because I think things may change, but I think the discussion is really productive.
Are there any other comments or questions before we essentially approve almost nothing at all? But conceptually, thank you for your time, and conceptually approve recommended definitions with the understanding that they may all be changed. So I would move to do so, to approve the recommendations in Attachment A.
I'll second.
Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
Okay, thank you. And thank you for everyone who came out to give public comment, and I do hope and encourage that you'll speak with Mr. Hardy and the staff, and, you know, we may all be able to get to our happy place very quickly. We'll see. That concludes the action items for today. We have two public comments on informational items, and then it is been our practice to take informational items on consent unless there are questions. But let's start with the public comment. Mr. Previn, you have comments on items 14 and 15.
Did you think you want 4 minutes?
Yeah, I don't know how to do that though.
Great, thank you. It's Eric Previn from Studio City, and I just wanted to raise up some interesting points in the executive director's report. Andrea Sheridan Orden is a tireless veteran, as I've said. She's been named as the fifth commissioner, and I think somebody has to say out loud, it's interesting to note that the composition will now be 100% women. I love women. I'm not opposed exactly to that, but it does raise the question of all the various fishies in the sea. You know, they couldn't come up. There are 14 council members who are male, I believe. And so it's interesting. Mike Feuer and Andrea Norton have a very special relationship, so I think that's part of it. It's also worth identifying that Orden was the consigliere for both Hilda Solis and Mike Feuer. So she's really a very good seasoned veteran for overseeing everything that happens in this community of closely knit people. As you recall, Nita Jenkins was Markley Thomas's. She was a former. So it's a love fest down here. Let's not kidders. And so I look forward to her service because she is apparently a smart person who can bring some of the guidance there. Now, have we elected a new president yet? Did that happen again? You again? Congratulations. Let me just say congratulations. I was very upset with last meeting's Kelly Lord approval, finally, as you know, and I wrote about it in the local City Watch. And I thought, you know, writing in City Watch is a good thing, and especially for this issue that we just talked about regarding 501c3s, because if you could get two points of view from good writers on that, it would help focus on, you know, close down the disagreement and find a place for agreement. So that's of note. I just don't understand how, with a straight face, we can be, running the enforcement racket that we are running when, having brought to your attention multiple episodes and instances of flatly egregious conduct, let me just finish. By the way, are we going right into public comment since are there other speakers behind me? Okay, fine. So, It just very much irks me that, that instances like, and I have to rattle them off because it's important, Mitchell Englander, a council member, running for supervisor, getting all sorts of love financially from a group in Arizona who are actively pursuing a procurement, yet we have not even glanced at that at all publicly, and I think we should. Mr. Kerkorian, a man who I respect, but was taking large contributions from unidentified trustees of a major Harvard-Westlake private entity. That's a problem for me that didn't come out, and there's no ruling or discussion. I think that this body should be looking closely at how do we restrict that, or at least make it so that they have to disclose it so people know, separate to me screaming into this tiny little room that nobody's listening to. So that's another example. And there are multiple other instances. One big problem that I think hopefully going forward we will get to, because everybody loves transparency and disclosure, is how can we improve the disclosure regarding LLCs? I've been vocal about that. There's one that I'm going to have to out right now called Celebrity, believe it or not, Celebrity Realty Holdings LLC. nice little item sloshed through the city council on that. I said, who are the members? I reached out to their lawyer, who froze. I reached out to the city, who froze. And now it is a corner parcel right down there near the big MLS stadium where they're seeking $22.5 million loan last week to help subsidiary to the arena, because obviously arenas and HUD money are not a perfect fit. So it upsets me, because we should know who the members are. I mean, we don't have to be, we can be agnostic about it, but the public is right. So if we're going to disclose, we have to disclose all these things, and we have to find a way that if you want to do business with the city of Los Angeles, tell us who you are. That's one detail. Finally, July 15th, 2016, in the New York Times, the team over there, the investigative team, looked at LA County. It's required reading for people who live here about influence in the county golf operations. American Golf Corporation, which is a big provider both here at the city and the county of lobbying activity, and they, the group who they represent, made fraudulent representations right into the five mugs of the Board of Supervisors, which will never stand. And Scott Walker is the partner of the guy who, believe it or not, conducted that, what I would describe as a fraud. And so I just hope that somebody does something. I hope that the Los Angeles Times, hope that it's not your jurisdiction, or maybe it is your jurisdiction, but someone ought to do it, because it's enough already. We do not, the public is entitled to fair and equitable information about who we're in business with. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for your comments. I do not have questions on the informational items, but I certainly welcome any questions on the informational items.
Comments on the informational items on item 14?
Yes.
Just a couple of things. In addition to welcoming Commissioner Orden, we also welcomed Armin Tarzi to the staff. He was with the FEC until just a few weeks ago, and he comes to us with great background in public service, and we're thrilled to have him on the staff. The other thing that I wanted to mention is sort of a PSA, just as a reminder that the Fair Political Practices Commission will be holding its meeting in the room next door on Thursday afternoon at 1 o'clock. So anyone who is interested in hearing more about their reorganizational efforts on the Public Political Reform Act can get information from our office about how to register and attend.
Maybe you can, I understand that the changes are fairly not sweeping, not substantive, and technical. So maybe maybe it'd be possible to send around to the commissioners what the changes are.
You know, we actually haven't even seen what the changes are. What we have been informed is that they are organizational and non-substantive, that there might be some changes just for consistency purposes and streamlining language purposes, but really that in its history it has been so piecemealed, I guess, in terms of improvements and changes, that it just needs to be better organized.
I was just going to make a comment to Mr. Hardy. Welcome. I mean, I know we welcomed you last time, but I feel like today was your real welcome meeting.
Yeah.
So.
Well,
thank you. I appreciate the welcome.
Sergio's probably so happy that he's not on the other end of my questions this time.
I won't speak to that.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone. Thank you to the staff. The informational items show how very busy you are. And none of this is easy, and I think you do a lot of it under a microscope, and we're very much appreciative. And thank you for the confidence of my fellow commissioners for reelecting me. And we look forward to seeing everyone in October.
I'll move to adjourn, right? Oh, we don't have to adjourn.
You don't need to be done.
Oh,
you're done.
Great.